on his broken rear legs. My stomach didn't so much as quiver, just cried impatiently for more food. I was hungry. Hungry. 11. That night I dreamed I was in the bedroom I had shared for so many years with Pam. She was asleep beside me and couldn't hear the croaking voice coming from somewhere below in the darkened house. Newly wed, nearly dead. Newly wed, nearly dead. It sounded like some mechanical device stuck in a groove. I shook my wife, but she just turned over, turned away from me. Dreams mostly tell the truth, don't they? I got up and went downstairs, holding the banister to compensate for my bad leg, and there was something odd about how I was holding that familiar length of polished rail. As I approached the bottom of the staircase, I realized what it was. Fair or not, it's a righty's world. Guitars are made for righties, and school desks, and the control panels on American cars. The banister of the house I'd lived in with my family was no exception. It was on the right because, although my company had built the house from my plans, my wife and both our daughters were right-handers, and majority rules. But still, my hand was trailing down the banister. Of course, I thought, because it's a dream. Just like this afternoon, you know. Gandalf was no dream, I thought back. And the voice of the stranger in my house, closer than ever, repeated, newly wed, nearly dead, over and over. Whoever it was, the person was in the living room. I didn't want to go in there. No, Gandalf was no dream, I thought. Maybe it was my phantom right hand having these thoughts. The dream was killing him. Had he died on his own, then? Was that what the voice was trying to tell me? Because I didn't think Gandalf had died on his own. I thought he had needed help. I went into my old living room. I wasn't conscious of moving my feet. I went in the way you move in dreams, as if it's really the world moving around you, streaming backward like some extravagant trick of projection. And there, sitting in Pam's old Boston rocker, was Reba the anger management doll, now grown to the size of an actual child. Her feet, clad in black Mary Janes, swung back and forth just above the floor at the end of horrible, boneless pink legs. Her shallow eyes stared at me. Her lifeless strawberry curls bounced back and forth. Her mouth was smeared with blood, and in my dream I knew it wasn't human blood or dog's blood, but the stuff that had oozed out of my mostly raw hamburger, the stuff I had licked off the paper plate when the meat was gone. "The bad frog chased us," Reba cried. "It has teeth." 12. That word, teeth, was still ringing in my head when I sat up with a cold puddle of October moonlight in my lap. I was trying to scream and producing only a series of silent gasps. My heart was thundering. I reached for the bedside lamp and mercifully avoided knocking it on the floor, although once it was on, I saw that I'd pushed the bass halfway out over the drop. The clock radio claimed it was 3:19 a.m. I swung my legs out of bed and reached for the phone. "If you really need me, call me," Kamen had said, "any time, day or night." And if his number had been in the bedroom phone's memory, I probably would have. But as reality reasserted itself, the cottage by Lake Phelan, not the house in Mendota Heights, no croaking voice downstairs, the urge passed. Reba, the anger management doll in the Boston rocker, and grown to the size of an actual child. Well, why not? I had been angry, although at Mrs. Feverow rather than at poor Gandalf. And I had no idea what toothy frogs had to do with the price of beans in Boston. The real question, it seemed to me, was about Monica's dog. Had I killed Gandalf, or had he just expired? Or maybe the question was why I'd been so hungry afterward. Maybe that was the question. So hungry for meat. "I took him in my arms," I whispered. "Your arm, you mean, because now one is all you've got, your good left." But my memory was taking him in my arms, plural, channeling my anger. It was red, away from that foolish woman with her cigarette and cell phone, and somehow back into myself, in some kind of crazy closed loop, taking him in my arms. Surely a hallucination, but yes, that was my memory. Taking him in my arms, cradling his neck with my left elbow so I could strangle him with my right hand, strangle him and put him out of his misery. I slept shirtless, so it was easy to look at my stump. I only had to turn my head. I could wiggle it, but not much more. I did that a couple of times, and then I looked up at the ceiling. My heartbeat was slowing a little. "The dog died of his injuries," I said, "in shock. An autopsy would confirm that." Except no one did autopsies on dogs that died after being crushed to bones and jelly by hummers driven by careless, distracted women. I looked at the ceiling and I wished this life was over. This unhappy life that had started out so confidently. I thought I would sleep no more that night, but eventually I did. In the end, we always wear out our worries. That's what Wireman says. How to Draw a Picture. 2. Remember that the truth is in the details. No matter how you see the world, or what style it imposes on your work as an artist, the truth is in the details. Of course, the devil's there, too. Everyone says so. But maybe truth and the devil are words for the same thing. It could be, you know. Imagine that baby girl again, the one who fell from the carriage. She struck the right side of her head, but it was the left side of her brain that suffered the worst insult. Contre coup, remember? The left side is where Broca's area is. Not that anyone knew that in the 1920s. Broca's area processes language. Smack it hard enough, and you lose your language, sometimes for a little while, sometimes forever. But, although they are closely related, saying is not seeing. The little girl still sees. She sees her five sisters, their dresses, how their hair is crazy combed by the wind when they come in from outside. She sees her father's mustache, now threaded with gray. She sees Nan Melda, not just the housekeeper, but the closest thing to a mother this little girl knows. She sees the scarf Nanny wraps around her head when she cleans. She sees the knot in the front, at the very top of Nan Melda's high brown forehead. She sees Nan Melda's silver bracelets and how they flash star points in the sunshine that falls through the windows. Details. Details. The truth is in the details. And does seeing cry out to saying, even in a damaged mind? A wounded brain? Oh, it must. It must. She thinks, my head hurts. She thinks, something bad happened and I don't know who I am, or where I am, or what all these bright surrounding images are. She thinks, Libet? Is my name Libet? I used to know. I could talk in the used to know. But now my words are like fish in the water. I want the man with the hair on his lip. She thinks, that's my daddy, but when I try to say his name, I call Erd, Erd, instead because one flies past my window. I see every feather. I see its eye like glass. I see its leg, how it bends like broke. And that word is crooked. My head hurts. Girls come in. Maria and Hannah come in. She doesn't like them the way she likes the twins. The twins are little like her. She thinks, I call Maria and Hannah the big meanies, and they used to know, and realizes she knows again. It's another thing that comes back. The name for another detail. She will forget again, but the next time she remembers, she will remember longer. She's almost sure of it. She thinks, when I try to say Hannah, I say Erd, Erd. When I try to say Maria, I say wee, wee. And they laugh, those meanies. I cry. I want my daddy and can't remember how to say him. That word is gone again. Words like birds, they fly and fly and fly away. My sisters talk, 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 talk. My throat is dry. I try to say thirsty. I say first, first. But they only laugh, those meanies. I'm under the bandage, smelling the iodine, smelling the sweaty, listening to them laugh. I scream at them, scream loud, and they run away. Nan Melda comes, her head all red because her hair is wrapped in the snarf. Her roundies flash, flash, flash in the sun. And you call those roundies bracelets. I say, first, first, and Nan Melda doesn't know. So then I say, ass, ass, and Nan makes me go potty, even though I don't need to go potty. I'm on the potty and see and point, ass, ass. Daddy comes in. What's this shouting about? With all white bubbles on his face, except for one smoothie. That's where he slid the thing that makes the hair go away. He sees how I point, he understands, fills up the glass. The room is full of sunny. Dust floats in the sunny, and his hand goes through the sunny with the glass, and you call that pretty. I drink every drink. I cry more afterwards, but from better. He kiss me, kiss me, kiss me, hug me, hug me, hug me, and I try to say him daddy, and still can't. Then I think around sideways to his name, and John is there. So I think that in my mind, and while I think John, I daddy out my mouth, and he hug me some more. She thinks, daddy is my first word on this side of the bad thing. The truth is in the details. 2. Big Pink. 1. Kamen's geographical worked, but when it came to fixing what was wrong with my head, I think the Florida part was coincidental. It's true that I lived there, but I never really lived there. No, Kamen's geographical worked because of Duma Key and Big Pink. For me, those places came to constitute their own world. I left St. Paul on November 10th with hope in my heart, but no real expectations. Kathy Green, the rehab queen, came to see me off. She kissed me on the mouth, hugged me hard, and whispered, "May all your dreams come true, Eddie." "Thanks, Kathy," I said. I was touched, even though the dream I fixed on was of Reba the anger management doll, grown to the size of an actual child sitting in the moonlit living room of the house I'd shared with Pam. That dream coming true I could live without. "And send me a picture from Disney World. I long to see you in mouse ears." "I will," I said, but I never got to Disney World. SeaWorld, Busch Gardens, or Daytona Speedway either. When I left St. Paul, flying in a Lear 55, successful retirement has its privileges. It was 24 and spitting the first snowflakes of another long northern winter. When I landed in Sarasota, it was 85 and sunny. Even crossing the tarmac to the private air terminal, still clumping along on my trusty red crutch, I thought I could feel my hip saying thank you. When I look back on that time, it's with the strangest stew of emotions, love, longing, terror, horror, regret, and the deep sweetness only those who've been near to death can know. I think it's how Adam and Eve must have felt. Surely they looked back at Eden, don't you think? As they started barefoot down the path to where we are now, in our glum political world of bullets and bombs and satellite TV. Looked past the angel guarding the shut gate with his fiery sword? Sure. I think they must have wanted one more look at the green world they had lost, with its sweet water and kind-hearted animals. And its snake, of course. 2. There's a charm bracelet of keys lying off the west coast of Florida. If you had your 7-league boots on, you could step from Longboat to Lido, from Lido to Siesta, from Siesta to Casey. The next step takes you to Duma Key, 9 miles long and a half mile wide at its widest, between Casey Key and Don Pedro Island. Most of it's uninhabited, a tangle of banyans, palms, and Australian pines, with an uneven, dune-rumpled beach running along the gulf edge. The beach is guarded by a waist-high band of sea oats. "The sea oats belong," Wireman once told me, "but the rest of that shit has no business growing without irrigation." For much of the time I spent on Duma Key, no one lived there but Wireman, the bride of the Godfather, and me. Sandy Smith was my realtor in St. Paul. I had asked her to find me a place that was quiet. I'm not sure I used the word isolated, but I may have, but still within reach of services. Thinking of Kamen's advice, I told Sandy I wanted to lease for a year, and price wasn't an object, as long as I wasn't getting skint too bad. Even depressed and in more or less constant pain, I was averse to being taken advantage of. Sandy fed my requirements into her computer, and Big Pink was what came out. It was just the luck of the draw. Except I don't really believe that, because even my earliest pictures seem to have, I don't know, something. Something. 3. On the day I arrived in my rental car, driven by Jack Cantori, the young man Sandy Smith had hired through a Sarasota employment agency, I knew nothing about the history of Duma Key. I only knew one reached it by crossing a WPA-era drawbridge from Casey Key. Once over this bridge, I observed that the northern tip of the island was free of the vegetation that tangled the rest. Instead, there was actual landscaping. In Florida, this means palms and grass undergoing nearly constant irrigation. I could see half a dozen houses strung along the narrow, patchy band of road leading south, the last one of them a huge and undeniably elegant hacienda. And close by, less than a football field's length from the Duma Key end of the drawbridge, I could see a pink house hanging over the gulf. "Is that it?" I asked, thinking, please let that be it. That's the one I want. "It is, isn't it?"
"I don't know, Mr. Freemantle," Jack said. "I know Sarasota, but this is the first time I've ever been on Duma. Never had any reason to come here."
He pulled up to the mailbox, which had a big red 13 on it. He glanced at the folder lying between us on the seat.
"This is it, all right. Salmon Point, number 13. I hope you're not superstitious."
I shook my head, not taking my eyes off it. I didn't worry about broken mirrors or crossing black cats' paths, but I'm very much a believer in, well, maybe not love at first sight, that's a little too red and scarlet for me, but instant attraction? Sure. It's the way I felt about Pam the first time I met her, on a double date. She was with the other guy. And it's the way I felt about Big Pink from the very first. She stood on pilings, with her chin jutting over the high tide line. There was a no trespassing sign slanting askew on an old gray stick beside the driveway, but I guess that didn't apply to me. "Once you sign the lease, you have it for a year," Sandy told me. "Even if it's sold, the owner can't kick you out until your time is up." Jack drove slowly up to the back door. Only with its face hanging over the Gulf of Mexico, that was the only door.
"I'm surprised they were ever allowed to build this far out," he said. "I suppose they did things different in the old days."
To him, the old days probably meant the 1980s.
"There's your car. Hope it's okay."
The car drawn up on the square of cracked pavement to the right of the house was the sort of anonymous American mid-sized the rental company specialized in. I hadn't driven since the day Mrs. Fevereau hit Gandalf, and barely gave it a glance. I was more interested in the boxy pink elephant I'd rented.
"Aren't there ordinances about building too close to the Gulf of Mexico?"
"Now, sure, but not when this place went up.
From a practical standpoint, it's all about beach erosion. I doubt if this place hung out that way when it was built."
He was undoubtedly right. I thought I could see at least 6 feet of the piling supporting the screened porch, the so-called Florida room. Unless those pilings were sunk 60 feet into the underlying bedrock, eventually the place was going into the Gulf of Mexico. It was only a matter of time. As I was thinking it, Jack Cantori was saying it. Then he grinned.
"Don't worry, though. I'm sure you'll get plenty of warning. You'll hear it groaning."
"Like the House of Usher," I said. His grin widened. "But it's probably good for another 5 years or so. Otherwise, it'd be condemned."
"Don't be so sure," I said.
Jack had reversed to the driveway door so the trunk would be easy to unload. Not a lot in there. 3 suitcases, 1 garment bag, a steel hard case with my laptop inside, and a knapsack containing some primitive art supplies, mostly pads and colored pencils. I traveled light when I left my other life. I figured what I'd need most in my new one was my checkbook and my American Express card.
"What do you mean?" he asked.
"Someone who could afford to build here in the first place could probably talk a couple of B and C inspectors around."
"B and C, what's that?"
For a moment I couldn't tell him. I could see what I meant. Men in white shirts and ties, wearing yellow high-impact plastic hard hats on their heads and carrying clipboards in their hands. I could even see the pens in their shirt pockets and the plastic pocket protectors to which they were clipped. The devil's in the details, right? But I couldn't think of what B and C stood for, although I knew it as well as my own name. And instantly I was furious. Instantly it seemed that making my left hand into a fist and driving it sideways into the unprotected Adam's apple of the young man sitting beside me was the most reasonable thing in the world, almost imperative, because it was his question that had hung me up.
"Mr. Fremantle?"
"Just a sec," I said, and thought, "I can do this." I thought of Don Field, the guy who had inspected at least half of my buildings in the 90s, or so it seemed, and my mind did its cross-patch thing. I realized I'd been sitting bolt upright, my hands clenched in my lap. I could see why the kid had sounded concerned. I looked like a man having a gastric episode or a heart attack. "Sorry," I said. "I had an accident. Banged my head. Sometimes my mind stutters."
"Don't worry about it," Jack said. "No biggie."
"B and C is building and code. Basically, they're the guys who decide if your building is going to fall down or not."
"You talking about bribes?"
My new young employee looked glum.
"Well, I'm sure it happens, especially down here. Money talks."
"Don't be so cynical. Sometimes it's just a matter of friendship. Your builders, your contractors, your building code inspectors, even your OSHA guys. They usually drink in the same bars, and they all went to the same schools." I laughed. "Reform schools, in some cases." Jack said, "They condemned a couple of beach houses at the north end of Casey Key when the erosion there sped up. One of them actually did fall into the drink." "Well, as you say, I'll probably hear it groaning, and it looks safe enough for the time being. Let's get my stuff inside." I opened my door, got out, then staggered as my bad hip locked up. If I hadn't gotten my crutch planted in time, I would have said hello to Big Pink by sprawling on her stone doorstep.
"I'll get the stuff in," Jack said.
"You better go in and sit down, Mr. Fremantle. A cold drink wouldn't hurt either. You look really tired." 4. The traveling had caught up with me, and I was more than tired. By the time I eased into a living room armchair, listing to the left as usual and trying to keep my right leg as straight as possible, I was willing to admit to myself that I was exhausted. Yet not homesick, at least not yet. As Jack went back and forth, stowing my bags in the bigger of the two bedrooms and putting the laptop on the desk in the smaller one, my eye kept being drawn to the living room's western wall, which was all glass, and the Florida room beyond it, and the Gulf of Mexico beyond that. It was a vast blue expanse, flat as a plate, on that hot November afternoon. And even with the sliding glass window wall shut, I could hear its mild and steady sighing. I thought, it has no memory. It was an odd thought, and strangely optimistic. When it came to memory and anger, I still had my issues. Jack came back from the guest room and sat on the arm of the couch, the perch, I thought, of a young man who wants to be gone. "You've got all your basic staples," he said, "plus salad in a bag, hamburger, and one of those cooked chickens in a plastic capsule. We call them astronaut chickens at my house. I hope that's okay with you."
"Fine."
2% milk."
"Also fine."
"And half and half. I can get you real cream next time if you want it." "You want to clog my one remaining artery?" He laughed. "There's a little pantry with all kinds of canned stuff. The cable's hooked up. The computer's internet ready. I got your Wi-Fi. Costs a little extra, but it's way cool. And I can get satellite installed if you want it." I shook my head. He was a good kid, but I wanted to listen to the Gulf sweet-talking me with words it wouldn't remember a minute later. And I wanted to listen to the house, see if it had anything to say. I had an idea maybe it did. The keys in an envelope on the kitchen table, car keys too, and a list of numbers you might need are on the fridge. I've got classes at FSU in Sarasota every day except Monday, but I'll be carrying my cell and I'll be coming by Tuesdays and Thursdays at 5, unless we make a different arrangement. Is that okay?
Yes.
I reached in my pocket and brought out my money clip.
I want to give you a little extra. You've been great. He waved it away.
Nah, this is a sweet gig, Mr. Fremantle. Good pay and good hours. I'd feel like a hound taking any extra.
That made me laugh, and I put my dough back in my pocket.
Okay.
Maybe you ought to take a nap, he said, getting up.
Maybe I will.
It was odd to be treated like Grandpa Walton, but I supposed I'd better get used to it.
What happened to the other house at the north end of Casey Key?
Huh?
You said one went into the drink. What happened to the other one?
Far as I know, it's still there.
Although if a big storm like Charlie ever hits this part of the coast dead on, it's going to be like a going out of business sale. Everything must go.
He walked over to me and stuck out his hand.
Anyway, Mr. Fremantle, welcome to Florida. I hope it treats you real well.
I shook with him.
Thank you. I hesitated.
Probably not long enough for him to notice, and I didn't get angry. Not at him, anyway.
Thanks for everything.
Sure. He gave me the smallest of puzzled looks as he went out, so maybe he did notice. Maybe he did notice, at that. I didn't care. I was on my own at last. I listened to shells and the gravel popping under his tires as his car started to roll. I listened to the motor fade. Less, least, gone. Now there was only the mild, steady sighing of the Gulf, and the beat of my own heart, soft and low. No clocks, not ringing, not bonging, not even ticking. I breathed deep and smelled the musty, slightly damp aroma of a place that's been shut up for a fairly long time, except for the weekly or bi-weekly ritual airing. I thought I could also smell salt and subtropical grasses, for which I as yet had no names. Mostly I listened to the sigh of the waves, so like the breath of some large sleeping creature, and looked out through the glass wall that fronted on the water. Because of Big Pink's elevation, I couldn't see the beach at all from where I was sitting, fairly deep in the living room. From my armchair I might have been on one of those big tankers that trudge their oily courses from Venezuela to Galveston. A high haze had crept over the dome of the sky, muting the pinpricks of light on the water. To the left were three palm trees silhouetted against the sky, their fronds ruffling in the mildest of breezes. The subjects of my first tentative post-accident sketch.
Don't look much like Minnesota there, Tom Riley had said.
Looking at them made me want to draw again. It was like a dry hunger, but not precisely in the belly. It made my mind itch, and oddly, the stump of my amputated arm.
Not now, I said. Later, I'm whipped.
I heaved myself out of the chair on my second try, glad the kid wasn't there to see the first backward flop and hear my childish cunt-licker cry of exasperation. Once I was up, I stood swaying on my crutch for a moment, marveling at just how tired I was. Usually, whipped was just something you said, but at that moment, it was exactly how I felt. Moving slowly, I had no intention of falling in here on my first day. I made my way into the master bedroom. The bed was a king, and I wanted nothing more than to go to it, sit on it, sweep the foolish decorative throw pillows, one bearing the likenesses of two cavorting cockers and the rather startling idea that maybe dogs are only people at their best, to the floor with my crutch, lie down and sleep for 2 hours, maybe three. But first I went to the bench at the end of the bed, still moving carefully, knowing how very easy it would be to tangle my feet and fall when I was at this level of exhaustion, where the kid had stacked two of my three suitcases. The one I wanted was on the bottom, of course. I shoved the one on top to the floor without hesitation and unzipped the front pocket of the other. Glassy blue eyes looked out with their expression of eternal disapproving surprise. Oh, you nasty man, I've been in here all this time. A fluff of lifeless orange-red hair sprang from confinement. Reba, the anger management doll, in her best blue dress and black Mary Janes. I lay on the bed with her crooked between my stump and my side. When I had made an adequate space for myself among the ornamental pillows, it was mostly the cavorting cockers I'd wanted on the floor. I laid her beside me. "I forgot his name," I said. I remembered it the whole way out here, then forgot it. Reba looked up at the ceiling, where the blades of the overhead fan were still and unmoving. I'd forgotten to turn it on. Reba didn't care if my new part-time hired man was Ike, Mike, or Andy Van Slyke. It was all the same to her. She was just rags stuffed into a pink body, probably by some unhappy child laborer in Cambodia or fucking Uruguay. "What is it?" I asked her. Tired as I was, I could feel the old dismal panic setting in, the old dismal anger, the fear that this would go on for the rest of my life or get worse. Yes, possible. They'd take me back to the convalescent home, which was really just hell with a fresh coat of paint. Reba didn't answer, that boneless bitch. "I can do this," I said, although I didn't believe it. And I thought, "Jerry, no, Jeff." Then, "You're thinking about Jerry Jeff Walker, asshole. Johnson, Gerald, great jumping Jehoshaphat." Starting to drift away, starting to drift into sleep, in spite of the anger and panic, tuning into the mild respiration of the gulf. "I can do this," I thought. Crosspatch, like when you remembered what B and C stood for. I thought of the kid saying, "They condemned a couple beach houses at the north end of Casey Key." And there was something there. My stump was itching like a mad bastard. But pretend that's some other guy's stump in some other universe. Meantime, chase that thing, that rag, that bone, that connection. Drifting away. Although if a big storm like Charlie ever hits this part of the coast dead on, and bingo. Charlie was a hurricane, and when hurricanes struck, I peeked at the Weather Channel like the rest of America, and their hurricane guy was... I picked up Reba. She seemed to weigh at least 20 pounds in my soupy, half-asleep state. "The hurricane guy is Jim Cantore," I said. "My help-out guy is Jack Cantore. Case fucking closed." I flopped her back down and closed my eyes. I might have heard that faint sigh from the gulf for another 10 or 15 seconds. Then I was asleep. I slept until sundown. It was the deepest, most satisfying sleep I'd had in 8 months. 5. I had done no more than nibble on the plane and consequently woke up ravenous. I did a dozen heel slides instead of the usual 25 to loosen my hip, made a quick trip to the bathroom, then lurched toward the kitchen. I was leaning on my crutch, but not as heavily as I might have expected, given the length of my nap. My plan was to make myself a sandwich, maybe two. I hoped for sliced bologna, but reckoned any lunch meat I found in the fridge would be okay. I'd call Ilsa after I ate and tell her I'd arrived safely. Ilsa could be depended upon to email everyone else with an interest in the welfare of Edgar Fremantle. Then I could take tonight's dose of pain medication and explore the rest of my new environment. The whole second floor awaited. What my plan hadn't taken into account was how the westward view had changed. The sun was gone, but there was still a brilliant orange band above the flat line of the gulf. It was broken in only one place, by the silhouette of some large ship. Its shape was as simple as a first grader's drawing, a cable stretched taut from the bow to what I assume was the radio tower, creating a triangle of light. As that light skied upward, orange faded to a breathless Maxfield Parrish blue-green that I had never seen before with my own eyes. And yet I had a sense of deja vu, as if maybe I had seen it in my dreams. Maybe we all see skies like that in our dreams, and our waking minds can never quite translate them into colors that have names. Above, in the deepening black, the first stars. I was no longer hungry, and no longer wanted to call Ilsa. All I wanted to do was draw what I was looking at. I knew I couldn't get all of it, but I didn't care. That was the beauty part. I didn't give shit one. My new employee... For a moment I blanked on his name again. Then I thought Weather Channel, then I thought Jack, case fucking closed. Had put my knapsack of art supplies in the second bedroom. I flailed my way out to the Florida room with it, carrying it awkwardly and trying to use my crutch at the same time. A mildly curious breeze lifted my hair. The idea that such a breeze and snow in St. Paul might exist at the same time, in the same world, seemed absurd to me, science fiction. I set the sack down on the long, rough wooden table, thought about snapping on a light, and decided against it. I would draw until I couldn't see to draw, and then call it a night. I sat in my awkward fashion, unzipped the bag, pulled out my pad. Artisan, it said on the front. Given the level of my current skills, that was a joke. I grubbed deeper and brought out my box of colored pencils. I drew and colored quickly, hardly looking at what I was doing. I shaded up from an arbitrary horizon line, stroking my Venus yellow from side to side with wild abandon, sometimes going over the ship. It would be the first tanker in the world to come down with yellow jaundice, I reckoned, and not caring. When I had the sunset band to what seemed like the right depth, it was dying fast now. I grabbed the orange and shaded more and heavier. Then I went back to the ship, not thinking, just putting a series of angular black lines on my paper. That was what I saw. When I was done, it was almost full dark. To the left, the three palms clattered. Below and beyond me, but not so far beyond now, the tide was coming back in. The Gulf of Mexico sighed, as if it had had a long day and there was more work to do yet. Overhead there were now thousands of stars, and more appearing even as I looked. This was here all the time, I thought, and recalled something Melinda used to say when she heard a song she really liked on the radio. It had me from hello. Below my rudimentary tanker, I scratched the word hello in small letters. So far as I can remember, and I'm better at that now, it was the first time in my life I named a picture. And, as names go, it's a good one, isn't it? In spite of all the damage that followed, I still think that's the perfect name for a picture drawn by a man who was trying his best not to be sad anymore, who was trying to remember how it felt to be happy. It was done. I put my pencil down, and that was when Big Pink spoke to me for the first time. Its voice was softer than the sigh of the Gulf's breathing, but I heard it quite well just the same. I've been waiting for you, it said. 6. That was my year for talking to myself and answering myself back. Sometimes other voices answered back as well, but that night it was just me, myself, and I. Houston, this is Fremantle. Do you copy, Houston? Leaning into the fridge, thinking, Christ, if this is basic staples, I'd hate to see what it would look like if the kid really decided to load up. I could wait out World War III. Roger, Fremantle, we copy. We have baloney, Houston. That's a go on the baloney. Do you copy? Roger, Fremantle, we read you loud and clear. What's your mayo situation? We were a go for mayo, too. I made 2 baloney sandwiches on white. Where I grew up, children were raised to believe mayonnaise, bologna, and white bread are the food of the gods, and ate them at the kitchen table. In the pantry, I found a stack of table talk pies, both apple and blueberry. I began to think of changing my will in favor of Jack Cantori. Almost sloshing with food, I went back to the living room, snapped on all the lights, and looked at hello. It wasn't very good, but it was interesting. The scribbled afterglow had a sullen, furnace-y quality that was startling. The ship wasn't the one I'd seen, but mine was interesting in a spooky sort of way. It was little more than a scarecrow ship, and the overlapping scribbles of yellow and orange had turned it into a ghost ship as well, as if that peculiar of sunset were shining right through it. I propped it atop the TV, against the sign reading, "The owner requests that you and your guests do not smoke indoors." I looked at it a moment longer, thinking it needed something in the foreground, a smaller boat maybe, just to lend the one on the horizon some perspective, but I no longer wanted to draw. Besides, adding something might fuck up what little charm the thing had. I tried the telephone instead, thinking if it wasn't working yet I could call Ilsa on my cell, but Jack had been on top of that too. I thought I'd probably get her machine, college girls are busy girls, but she answered on the first ring. Daddy?
That startled me so much at first I couldn't speak. And she said it again.
Dad?
Yes, I said. How did you know? The callback number's got a 941 area code. That's where that Duma place is. I checked. Modern technology. I can't catch up. How are you, kiddo?
Fine. The question is, how are you?
I'm all right. Better than all right, actually. The fellow you hired? He's got game. The bed's made and the fridge is full. I got here and took a 5-hour nap. There was a pause, and when she spoke again, she sounded more concerned than ever. You're not hitting those pain pills too hard, are you? Because OxyContin's supposed to be a sort of Trojan horse. Not that I'm telling you anything you didn't already know. Nope. I stick to the prescribed dosage. In fact, I stopped.
What, Daddy?
What? Now she sounded almost ready to hail a cab and take a plane. I was just realizing I skipped the 5 o'clock Vicodin. I checked my watch. And the 8 o'clock OxyContin, too, I'll be damned. How bad's the pain? Nothing a couple Tylenol won't handle, at least until midnight. It's probably the change in climate, she said, and the nap. I had no doubt those things were part of it, but I didn't think they were all of it. Maybe it was crazy, but I thought drawing had played a part. In fact, it was something I sort of knew. We talked for a while, and little by little I could hear that concern going out of her voice. What replaced it was unhappiness. She was understanding, I suppose, that this thing was really happening, that her mother and father weren't just going to wake up one morning and take it back. But she promised to call Pam and email Melinda and let them know I was still in the land of the living. Don't you have email there, Dad? I do, but tonight you're my email, Cookie. She laughed, sniffed, laughed again. I thought to ask if she was crying, then thought again. Better not to, maybe. Ilsa? I better let you go now, honey. I want to shower off the day. Okay, but... A pause. Then she burst out. I hate to think of you all the way down there in Florida, by yourself. Maybe falling on your ass in the shower. It's not right. Cookie, I'm fine, really. The kid, his name's... Hurricanes, I thought, Weather Channel. His name's Jim Cantore. But that was a case of right church, wrong pew. Jack, I mean. That's not the same, and you know it. Do you want me to come? Not unless you want your mother to scalp us both bald, I said. What I want is for you to stay right where you are, and TCB, darling, I'll stay in touch. Okay. But take care of yourself. No stupid shit. No stupid shit. Roger that, Houston. Huh? Never mind. I still want to hear you promise, Dad. For one terrible and surpassingly eerie moment, I saw Ilsa at 11. Ilsa, dressed in a Girl Scout's uniform and looking at me with Monica Goldstein's shocked eyes. Before I could stop the words, I heard myself saying, "Promise, big swear, mother's name." She giggled. Never heard that one before. There's a lot about me you don't know. I'm a deep one. If you say so. A pause, then. Love you. Love you, too. I put the phone gently back into its cradle and stared at it for a long time. 7. Instead of showering, I walked down the beach to the water. I quickly discovered my crutch was no help on the sand. Was, in fact, a hindrance. But once I was around the corner of the house, the water's edge was less than 2 dozen steps away. That was easy if I went slow. The surge was mild, the incoming wavelets only inches high. It was hard to imagine this water whipped into a destructive hurricane frenzy. Impossible, actually. Later, Wireman would tell me God always punishes us for what we can't imagine. That was one of his better ones. I turned to go back to the house, then paused. There was just enough light to see a deep carpet of shells, a drift of shells, under the jutting Florida room. At high tide, I realized, the front half of my new house would be almost like the foredeck of a ship. I remember Jack saying I'd get plenty of warning if the Gulf of Mexico decided to eat the place, that I'd hear it groaning. He was probably right. But then I was also supposed to get plenty of warning on a job site when a heavy piece of equipment was backing up.
I limped back to where my crutch leaned against the side of the house and took the short plank walk around to the door. I thought about the shower and took a bath instead, going in and coming out the careful side-saddle way Kathy Green had showed me in my other life. Both of us dressed in bathing suits, me with my right leg looking like a badly butchered cut of meat. Now the butchery was in the past. My body was doing its miracle work. The scars would last a lifetime, but even they were fading. Already fading. Dried off and with my teeth brushed, I crutched into the master bedroom and surveyed the king, now divested of decorative pillows. "Houston," I said, "we have bed."
"Roger, Freemantle," I replied. "You're a go for bed."
"Sure, why not?"
I'd never sleep, not after that whopper of a nap, but I could lie down for a while.
My leg still felt pretty good, even after my expedition to the water, but there was a knot in my lower back and another at the base of my neck. I lay down. No, sleep was out of the question. But I turned off the lamp anyway, just to rest my eyes. I'd lie there until my back and neck felt better, then dig a paperback out of my suitcase and read. "Just lie here for a while." That was... I got that far, and then I was gone again. There were no dreams. 8. I slipped back to some sort of consciousness in the middle of the night, with my right arm itching and my right hand tingling and no idea of where I was. Only that from below me something vast was grinding and grinding and grinding. At first I thought it was machinery, but it was too uneven to be machinery, and too organic somehow. Then I thought of teeth. But nothing had teeth that vast, nothing in the known world, at least. Breathing, I thought, and that seemed right. But what kind of an animal made such a vast grinding sound when it drew in breath? And God, that itch was driving me crazy, all the way up my forearm to the crease of the elbow. I wanted to scratch it, reaching across my chest with my left hand, and of course there was no elbow, no forearm, and I scratched nothing but the bedsheet. That brought me fully awake, and I sat up. Although the room was still very dark, enough starlight came in through the westward-facing window for me to see the foot of the bed, where one of my suitcases rested on a bench. That locked me in place. I was on Duma Key, just off the west coast of Florida, home of the newlywed and the nearly dead. I was in the house I was already thinking of as Big Pink, and that grinding sound.
"It's shells," I murmured, lying back down. "Shells under the house. The tide's in."
I loved that sound from the first, when I woke up and heard it in the dark of night, when I didn't know where I was, who I was, or what parts were still attached. It was mine. It had me from hello. 3. Drawing on new resources. 1. What came next was a period of recovery and transition from my other life to the one I lived on Duma Key. Dr. Kamen probably knew that during times like that, most of the big changes are going on inside. Civil unrest, revolt, revolution, and finally mass executions as the heads of the old regime tumbled into the basket at the foot of the guillotine. I'm sure the big man had seen such revolutions succeed and seen them fail. Because not everyone makes it into the next life, you know. And those who do don't always discover heaven's golden shore. My new hobby helped in my transition, and Ilsa helped, too. I'll always be grateful for that. But I'm ashamed of going through her purse while she was asleep. All I can say is, at the time, I seemed to have no choice. 2. I woke up the morning after my arrival feeling better than I had since my accident. But not so well I skipped my morning pain cocktail. I took the pills with orange juice, then went outside. It was 7 o'clock. In St. Paul, the air would have been cold enough to gnaw on the end of my nose, but on Duma, it felt like a kiss. I leaned my crutch where I'd leaned it the night before and walked down to those docile waves again. To my right, any view of the drawbridge and Casey Key beyond was blocked out by my own house. To the left, however, In that direction, the beach seemed to stretch on forever, a dazzling white margin between the blue-gray gulf and the sea oats. I could see one speck far down, or maybe it was two. Otherwise, that fabulous picture-postcard shore was entirely deserted. None of the other houses were near the beach, and when I faced south, I could only see a single roof, what looked like an acre of orange tile mostly buried in palms. It was the hacienda I had noticed the day before. I could block that out with the palm of my hand and feel like Robinson Crusoe. I walked that way, partly because as a southpaw, turning left had come naturally to me my whole life, mostly because that was the direction I could see in, and I didn't go far. No great beach walk that day. I wanted to make sure I could get back to my crutch, but that was still the first. I remember turning around and marveling at my own footprints in the sand. In the morning light, each left one was as firm and bold as something produced by a stamping press. Most of the right ones were blurry, because I had a tendency to drag that foot. But setting out, even those had been clear. I counted my steps back. The total was 38. By then my hip was throbbing. I was more than ready to go in, grab a yogurt cup from the fridge and see if the cable TV worked as well as Jack Cantori claimed. Turned out, it did. 3. And that became my morning routine. Orange juice, walk, yogurt, current events. I became quite chummy with Robin Mead, the young woman who anchors headline news from 6 to 10 a.m. Boring routine, right? But the surface events of a country laboring under a dictatorship can appear boring, too. Dictators like boring. Dictators love boring, even as great changes are approaching beneath the surface. A hurt body and mind aren't just like a dictatorship, they are a dictatorship. There is no tyrant as merciless as pain, no despot so cruel as confusion. That my mind had been as badly hurt as my body was a thing I only came to realize once I was alone and all other voices dropped away. The fact that I had tried to choke my wife of 25 years for doing no more than trying to wipe the sweat off my forehead after I told her to leave the room was the very least of it. The fact that we hadn't made love a single time in the months between the accident and the separation, didn't even try, wasn't at the heart of it either, although I thought it was suggestive of the larger problem. Even the sudden and distressing bursts of anger weren't at the heart of the matter. That heart was a kind of pulling away. I don't know how else to describe it. My wife had come to seem like someone other. Most of the people in my life also felt other. And the dismaying thing was that I didn't much care. In the beginning, I had tried to tell myself that the otherness I felt when I thought about my wife and my life was probably natural enough in a man who sometimes couldn't even remember the name of that thing you pulled up to close your pants, the zoomer, the zimmer, the zippity-doo-dah. I told myself it would pass, and when it didn't, and Pam told me she wanted a divorce, what followed my anger was relief, because now that other feeling was okay to have, at least toward her. Now she really was other. She'd taken off the Fremantle uniform and quit the team. During my first weeks on Duma, that sense of otherness allowed me to prevaricate easily and fluently. I answered letters and emails from people like Tom Riley, Kathy Green, and William Bozeman III, the immortal Bozy, with short jottings. I'm fine, the weather's fine, the bones are mending. That bore little resemblance to my actual life. And when their communications first slowed and then stopped, I wasn't sorry. Only Ilsa seemed to be on my team. Only Ilsa refused to turn in her uniform. I never got that other feeling about her. Ilsa was still on my side of the glass window, always reaching out. If I didn't email her every day, she called. If I didn't call her once every third day, she called me. And to her, I didn't lie about my plans to fish in the Gulf or check out the Everglades. To Ilsa, I told the truth, or as much of it as I could without sounding crazy. I told her, for instance, about my morning walks along the beach, and that I was walking a little farther each day. but not about the numbers game, because it sounded too silly. Or maybe obsessive-compulsive is the term I actually want. Just 38 steps from Big Pink on that first morning. On my second one, I helped myself to another huge glass of orange juice, and then walked south along the beach again. This time I walked 45 steps, which was a long distance for me to totter crutchless in those days. I managed by telling myself it was really only 9. That sleight of mind is the basis of the numbers game. You walk 1 step, then 2 steps, then 3, then 4, rolling your mental odometer back to 0 each time until you reach 9. And when you add the numbers, 1 through 9 together, you come out with 45. If that strikes you as nuts, I won't argue. The third morning, I coaxed myself into walking 10 steps from Big Pink, sans crutch, which is really 55, or about 90 yards round trip. A week later, I was up to 17, and when you add those numbers, you come out with 153. I'd get to the end of that distance, look back at my house, and marvel at how far away it looked. I'd also sag a little at the thought of having to walk all the way back again. You can do it, I'd tell myself. It's easy, just 17 steps is all. That's what I'd tell myself. But I didn't tell Ilsa. A little farther each day, stamping out footprints behind me. By the time Santa Claus showed up at the Beneva Road Mall, where Jack Cantore sometimes took me shopping, I realized an amazing thing. All my southbound footprints were clear. The right sneaker print didn't start to drag and blur until I was on my way back. Exercise becomes addictive, and rainy days didn't put a stop to mine. The second floor of Big Pink was one large room. There was an industrial-strength, rose-colored carpet on the floor, and a huge window facing the Gulf of Mexico. There was nothing else. Jack suggested that I make a list of furniture I wanted up there and said he'd get it from the same rental place where he'd gotten the downstairs stuff, assuming the downstairs stuff was all right. I assured him it was fine, but said I wouldn't need much on the second floor. I liked the emptiness of that room. It called to my imagination. What I wanted, I said, was 3 things. A plain straight-back chair, an artist's easel, and a Cybex treadmill. Could Jack provide those things? He could and did, in 3 days. From then until the end, it was the second floor for me when I wanted to draw or paint, and it was the second floor for exercise on days when the weather closed in. The single straight-back chair was the only real piece of furniture that ever lived up there during my tenure in Big Pink. In any case, there weren't that many rainy days. Not for nothing is Florida called the Sunshine State. As my southward strolls grew longer, the speck or specks I'd seen on that first morning eventually resolved into 2 people. At least on most days it was 2. One was in a wheelchair and wearing what I thought was a straw hat. The other pushed her, then sat beside her. They appeared on the beach around 7 a.m. Sometimes, the one who could walk left the one in the wheelchair for a little while, only to come back with something that glittered in the early sun. I suspected a coffee pot, a breakfast tray, or both. I further suspected they came from the huge hacienda with the acre or so of orange-tiled roof. That was the last house visible on Duma Key before the road ran into the enthusiastic overgrowth that covered most of the island. 4. I couldn't quite get used to the emptiness of the place. It's supposed to be very quiet, Sandy Smith had told me. But I had still pictured the beach filling up by midday, couples sunning on blankets and slathering each other with tanning lotion, college kids playing volleyball with iPods strapped to their biceps, little kids in saggy swimsuits paddling at the edge of the water while jet skis buzzed back and forth 40 feet out. Jack reminded me that it was only December. When it comes to Florida tourism, he said, the month between Thanksgiving and Christmas is Morgue City. Not as bad as August, but still pretty dead. Also, he gestured with his arm. We were standing out by the mailbox with the red 13 on it, me leaning on my crutch, Jack looking sporty in a pair of denim cutoffs and a fashionably tattered Tampa Bay Devil Rays shirt. Not exactly tourist country here. See any trained dolphins? What you got is 7 houses,
counting that big one down there. And the jungle, where there's another house falling apart, by the way. That's according to some stories I've heard on KZK. What's with Duma, Jack? 9 miles of prime